House Committee on Environment and Energy, June 8, 1987, Hearing Room E. Work session, House Bill 3390, Senate Bill 508, House Bill 2144, House Bill 2687, Senate Bill 1011, House Bill 3125, Senate Bill 967, Senate Bill 614, House Bill 2656.
House Environment and Energy Committee to order. Clerk will note that I think all of our members are here except all of our members are here. We do have to go back to the floor at 3, but when that is over, we will be back to the committee because we've got a number of things to do. If you want to look at the agenda, if anybody has the agenda, a number of these, several of these bills on the docket for today, we did dispose of on Friday. HB 3124 is done. Senate Bill 968 is done. And Senate Bill 708 took action on. And 890.
Just sit.
All right, and 2144 is on twice by mistake. So I guess we're going to finally hear that today, aren't we?
Yes.
A couple of other items before we get into our work session bills. We did put in your packet a couple of advertisements that appeared in the Oregonian this weekend. One is a fourth of a page. I think the Oregon Environmental Council actually paid for, well, that the council plus another group in reference to the pesticides. You remember the ad sponsored by the killers? You remember that, Representative? So here's that ad. And then there's a full-page ad with a coupon on the bottom from the Waste Management of Oregon blitzing the area on the whole question of the landfill. Okay. So you might find those of use. We now have, yes, Representative.
I don't know what you're planning to do, but I wonder if you might take care of 2656 quickly.
Oh, yes, we'll be there in a minute. Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before we start committee bills?
We haven't gotten there yet. We'll wait a minute. We have, for your information, the committee's information, a copy of the bill that will be introduced on the timber land use issue. Not all the pieces have been totally resolved. We are introducing this as an individual bill so that everybody who wants the lady to sign on to it can. And if any members of the committee want to sign it before we drop it today, you're free to do that. Carol has a back that you can sign. We will hold a hearing on this on Wednesday.
You have a motion?
No, you don't need anything.
Okay.
So just for your information, you'll have copies of it. We will begin our hearing on Wednesday. And we will be moving expeditiously with it, but there's an awful lot of stuff to do and bring you up to date, you know where we're at and so forth. But as I said, not all the pieces are done. Representative Ekus, we have a bill back from the House because I think technically we left something out, so why don't you bring that up?
I have a copy of the bill with me. It's 2656. It's the social contract legislation. We had taken out language. We had one of the requirements was price and service competition. We took out the language that said, and which can reasonably be expected to continue to exist. We amended that out in committee, but when the bill was reported and then printed, it came out printed with that language in it. So we need to. I don't believe we need to.
I don't think we formally need to reconsider it, but we need to correct it.
We need to officially take that out of the printed bill.
Anybody have a copy of the bill?
Yep, you're absolutely right. That's why I sent it to Legislative Council, and they didn't take it out.
Yeah, it's on page 3, line 5. We need to delete the words "and can reasonably be expected to continue to exist" from the printed bill.
They just missed it.
Okay. Anybody need to look at the bill?
Here. You did that originally.
We did that here.
Yeah.
I think everybody understands what it is. We simply need to, we took action on it, it was just printed wrong, and so we need to correct it. Do I have a motion to correct it and take that part out that was, that showed up?
So moved.
Any problem with it? All right, we'll put it back as it should be. And move on, Representative Johnson?
I just would like to ask that our committee staff provide us with any, since we are under the one-hour rule, any notices of agenda, any agenda notice be sent to, at least for me, to my office, so that my staff people know where I'm at. And it's really, when they're short notice, it's really critical that we get this information to, so that we have at least that time to review what's coming down.
Okay. Thank you. Good. Anyone else before we get into the agenda for today?
Mr. Chairman, I think that should go for all of the
yes, everybody.
Special notice.
Do we need to take an official motion to send 2656 back to the court?
Well, we probably, just to be sure, you move to send 2650?
Six.
Okay. To the floor. We've made the correction. Why don't you call a roll on it, Pat, just to make sure that we've covered our bases on it.
Bill already has had second reading, so...
Had second reading, so I don't know that we need to do anything more.
Yeah. Just get it back to the floor.
It had gone through the floor, actually.
In fact, you don't need to call it. You don't have to call the roll. Anybody have any objection to sending it back to the floor? All right, we've got a motion. Let's do it that way. Let's then move on to the material for today. Are we ready on 2144, Ron?
No, I think so, yes.
All right. I'll open the work session on House Bill 2144. And Representative Ekus.
I'm going to go down there and still have forewarned.
Yeah, it was just a correction. Normally you'd be right there.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't realize that. Then there has to be a vote to send it back out.
Which is what?
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay, you're right then.
Let me ask, Ron, before we start, on reference to that timber land use bill, which we're anxious to get upstairs and drop so we can get it printed and be referred back to the committee, if there's anyone on the committee that wants to sign it as a sponsor, Carol will bring it around. And if you don't have to sign it, you can sign it. We'll ask people, we'll give people an opportunity later. But if you want to sign it now, we need to get rid of it. So go ahead, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ron Ekus, District 39. if you recall, House Bill 2144 came to us early in the session, providing for what had been called incentive rates or promotional rates. And at that time, I had several concerns, as well did a number of others, as to, I guess I'd categorize them in three ways. One, whether or not incentive rates are legal or should be legal. Two, what effect the incentive rates would have on future energy use. Three, what is the equity of the incentive rates. And four, what effect they might have on the transfer of costs on a local exchange. Or excuse me, not... got a too much telecommunications on the residential exchange with the Bonneville Power Administration. Through a series of meetings, we've tried to develop legislation that would address those concerns. And what you have before you are amendments 2144-3. What essentially they do, they take the amendments that were initially introduced, brought to us by the commission. The amendments initially came from PP&L. The commission brought them to us. And we have added to those, starting on page one, line 18, some criteria that need to be considered before incentive rates would be allowed. And I believe that these criteria allow, make sure that the concerns that people had over the effect and the equity of incentive rates are taken into account. I believe it ought to be taken into the there's a number of things that this ought to be taken in the context of. One is, I have a letter from the governor indicating an interest in bringing together the regional power council members, the public utility commission, private utilities, public utilities, conservation groups, and beginning to develop an overall strategy on how we will manage our surplus energy, how we can best use it to our advantage, and how we can use it in a way that will avoid us having to all of a sudden do a lot of conservation and a lot of power generation at the same time as we approach deficit. That happened early in the discussions, and a commitment on the part of the governor to look at that part of the incentive rate issue. We also have an order from the commission on incentive rates that sets some guidelines as to how the rates will be considered and what things will be looked at. Also have a white paper that was submitted to the chair that outlines the commission's approach to incentive rates. I think with those three documents and these amendments that we have, I think, an acceptable package that provides some guidelines. The many of those who were concerned about the conservation, about the incentive rates as they might be used, suggested some changes or some criteria. And I think if I go over those, you will see between the order and the legislation that while we have not expressly adopted those, we have made it very clear that those considerations have to be taken into account. One was a promotional rate must fully recover the immediate costs of serving its recipient. The other was that the rate may not be approved until the commission determined, following notice and comment, that the rate won't preempt alternative sales opportunities that would be preferable on economic or environmental grounds. The other is that the design of the promotional rate must provide firm assurances that other customers won't be compelled at some future date to share in the cost of generating resources to serve the recipient of the promotional rate. Now, those assurances could take either of two forms: interruptibility guarantees or binding commitments from the recipients of the rates to pay when and if necessary the costs of new generating capacity imposed upon the system. In addressing those, you will see that in the criteria that the commission must at a minimum consider the following criteria, and they begin on line 22, page 1. Whether the rate generates revenues at least sufficient to cover relevant short and long run costs of the utility during the term of the rates. Whether the rate generates revenues sufficient to ensure that just and reasonable rates are established for the remaining customers of
Mr.
the utility.
Chair,
Representative
Ekus at this point.
Yes.
Representative Ekus, on that second criterion, just and reasonable, that to me is undefined, and that would probably have to be defined in some kind of administrative rule.
Mr. Chair, perhaps the PUC staff is better equipped to answer this than I am, but just and reasonable is a statutory requirement, existing statutory requirement. and there is an entire history of termination of just and reasonable and PUC documents and orders.
Under the scope of this, of the amendments.
Excuse me just a minute. Do we have somebody here from the PUC staff? Is somebody's coming? Okay, go ahead.
Under the scope of these amendments, especially the second criterion, if we're going to give a promotional rate or incentive rate or whatever you want to call it to, say, a industrial customer, isn't somebody going to have to pay a higher rate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berea, someone will have to pay a higher rate if the incentive rate is offered to an existing customer. And in fact, as a testimony was presented before, many of the contracts were incentive rate contracts to existing customers designed to keep them on the system. The judgment was made by the Public Utility Commissioner that the benefits to the ratepayers, even the remaining ratepayers, even though they would have to be paying more, that the benefits to them were greater than if that customer left the system. Now, there are a couple of things that are also taken into account in making that determination. One is the leaving, whether or not if they left the system. But there are also other considerations that are taken into account. For example, requirements for the interruptibility of power, the alternative sales opportunities that were mentioned by the conservation groups concerned about that are taken into account when the avoided cost is determined. And the other factor is that for the purposes of rate making, rates are determined on the basis as if there was no discount rate. So stockholders essentially have to bite the bullet for the discount.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up on that?
Yes, go ahead.
So,
could I ask the representative of PUC come on up?
So what you're saying is that it's possible under this that residential customers will have to pay higher rates in order to subsidize the promotional rate?
Representative Anderson. Go ahead. Why don't you ask that question?
Yes, sir. I'm Bill Warren with PUC. Mr. Chairman, Representative Berea, as I understand your question, to mean that residential customers would be paying higher rates as a result of a special contract rate, that's possible. Our point is, though, that they would pay even higher rates without the special contract. So one has to admit that the special contracts that you've reviewed in the context of this legislation have resulted in rate reductions for those customers under special contracts. But our concept has been that if the special contract had not existed at all of the revenues would have been lost to the utility, and residential customers would have even paid higher rates than without the special contract.
Mr. Chair, so my initial question when you were out of the room was the definition of just and reasonable rates. And I guess what I'm being told is that because of economic leverage, because a larger customer, say industrial, needs, can say, I want to switch to a different energy source, and is it kind of like economic blackmail? Or some economic leverage? Let me use that word. Is that a better way to describe it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berea, it's certainly a market-determined rate. I believe that's the way economists would define it rather than economic blackmail or some such thing. But they're rates based upon the value of the service to the customer.
Mr. Chairman, you follow up on that?
Yes, go ahead.
When you're talking about industrial customers, they're dealing both in the competitive energy, like, say, for electricity, which is regulated, versus a deregulated industry like oil. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
So, in one sense, we don't really have a market rate, since for, like, electrical rates, they're determined by the PUC or they're approved by the PUC. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, they are. However, the customer's alternative, for example, for an industrial customer, may be cogeneration. generated by oil or perhaps wood waste at a paper mill, and that's the value of electric service to that customer. What the utility is trying to do is compete with that value of service, retain the customer's sales to the benefit of all other customers.
Mr. Chair, one last question. Did the League of Women Voters sign off on the Dash 3 amendments, Representative Ekus?
League of Women Voters was not involved in any of the discussions.
Thank you.
I didn't know they had an interest.
They opposed the bill at the initial hearing.
Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The two criteria that we've already mentioned are rates that generate revenues at least sufficient to cover the relevant short and long run costs. Whether the rate generates revenues sufficient to ensure that just and reasonable rates are established for remaining customers of the utility. Those also apply to telephone companies as well. We had some discussions with the telephone companies, and those two apply to telecommunications industry. The remaining ones do not. Other criteria are whether or not it's appropriate to incorporate interruptibility of service in the utility's rate agreement with the customer, and whether the rate agreement requires the utility to acquire new resources to serve the load. Documents we've received from the PUC point out that these rates would be limited to those instances where you have viable alternatives to the utility service. The incentive rate must exceed all the relevant costs, as the system nears capacity, the minimum rate must reflect the impact of system expansion on average costs. The staff has tended to uses the avoided cost estimates to measure the additional cost of providing service under the incentive rate. And when doing that avoided cost, they account for the revenue that would be foregone by serving the customer instead of making a non-firm sale to the region or to California. In addition, as Mr. Warren pointed out, some of the existing contracts do give the utility the right to develop a cogeneration facility at the site or to reduce the amount of power that it supplies. And these are options that can be exercised if it would otherwise be obligated to acquire expensive new resources. The commission has taken an approach where if an incentive rate is approved, the rate needs to be designed to achieve the highest possible contribution to the fixed cost from the qualifying customers. And the rate treatment, as I pointed out to Representative Berea, provides an incentive for the utilities to negotiate the highest rate and the maximum contribution possible. So they only take effect when there is the existence of price competition or a service alternative. And by the criteria that we've added, I think we've taken into account considerations for just and reasonable rates, for maximum contribution, for the interruptibility of power, and for the requirements that if during the length of the contract new resources are required, that the industry receiving the discounted rate will either be paying for those new resources as any other industry would, or they have the option of interruptibility of power or cogeneration. On page 2, line 6, sub D, we have addressed the concern that EWIP particularly and some of the other public utilities had about what effect these incentive rates may have on the transfer of costs through the residential exchange. What D requires, in our understanding of it, is that there would be the PUC would identify and quantify the effect of the rate on the average system cost through the residential exchange. In this manner, the public utilities would have an opportunity. They would have some quantifiable data upon which to see what the effect might be, and then they could make their case to the PUC based upon whether that's a minute effect or whether it's a has a much larger effect, and they still have the options available to them through the Bonneville Power Administration of what is and is not included by BPA in the average system cost. So I think we've tried to address their concern, at least to the point where we do not prohibit a transfer of cost, but we at least make sure that there's an identification of what the transfer might be so that the publics can make their own case to the PUC and to BPA.
Representative Anderson.
Well, on page 2, starting line 80, we speak with interruptibility of service. Would it be appropriate also to put in there, would it do damage to the bill if we also included off-peak use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I haven't thought that through. That's a fairly clear term in the utility industry. I don't imagine it would cause any problems. Interruptibility is a very clear term, too, and that's what we have.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I brought it up, it was a big issue that was down our way with Hannah Nickel, who were not able to operate under rate adjustments for 24-hour use, but they were able, for a time at least, to successfully operate at a lowered rate by using 12 hours at night and 24 hours on Saturday and Sunday at a lower rate, which was acceptable. In that case, they were a DSI with Bonneville. And I just thought maybe if Bonneville was comfortable with that type of an arrangement in certain industries, that we might want to be able to address that at the same time, maybe as interruptibility.
Yes, Representative Anderson, bear in mind, if you would, please, the list we have in the proposed legislation is a minimum checklist for the Commission. Obviously, if the Commission wants to incorporate other features in the contract or require the utility to incorporate other features or to consider other items in assessing the contract, it may do so. This is a minimum that must be reviewed.
Well, then another question. With this legislation, then you feel that you could address that as an alternative?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, fine. I just wanted to get it on record.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no other further questions, I do want to point out an agreed upon change in sub D, which would agreed upon between PUC, myself, and UWIB, which would take out the terms on line 7, take out the words over the contract term. And appropriate time, I'd propose that as an amendment to what we have here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like to hear the reasons why it's necessary to remove that. Seems reasonable to leave it in.
Well, Mr. Chairman, part of the reason is the contract term may in fact be very short, whereas the effects of the rate on the average system cost can be beyond that. It also would allow there may be filings for rates that are incentive rates for residential customers that do not have contracts, that are essentially it's not a contract in the same way that you have a contract with an electric customer. It is a different rate for residential customers and it's not a contract.
Well, not quite clear. Obviously, there's going to be a contract, so how do you address it?
Mr. Chairman, in the case of residential customers, no, I don't believe that it's not a contract in the same sense that you have a rate, but you do not have a contract. with the industrial customers, you have a contract, specified contract with one particular customer. In the residential sector, you do not.
Maybe I'm reading it wrong. The way I read it, we're speaking of the contract for the industrial customer.
We are speaking to incentive or discounted rates that are not limited to industrial customers. They are limited only to cases of where there are price and service, price competition or service alternative. Or where you have instances that are determined by the differences in the service being provided or the conditions of service. Those are what we are adding to, and it is not limited to industrial contracts. The contracts which we have reviewed and had presented to us have been in relation to industrial customers.
But, Chair, I wonder if we could hear maybe from the AG on that, what it does with it in, what it does with it out.
Paul Graham with the Attorney General's Office. I think the reason contract was in there initially, Representative Anderson, is that most of the so-called industrial incentive rates are contracts that last for a specific term, 5 years, 10 years, 7 years, 8 years.
There's one he can recycle it within his own system. He normally has enough material he can burn it within an approved burner. And to apply it to the ground does not seem to be in a very environmental, practical program. And my name is Bill Briggs from Fuel Processors.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Berea.
I don't understand Representative Anderson's question, but can you...
Well, it might be an area around, let's take a mill, for example. We have a lot of log trucks coming in and out. They service, they have their own logging trucks and so on. They want to suppress dust on their own property where they're dumping those logs and so on. I think that should be allowed. Other areas might be gravel parking lots that service a lot of their own vehicles. They have a fleet of cars or whatever, dust suppression.
As long as they understand that they are environmentally at risk for what they're putting down there, and they are degenerating the quality and value of their own land.
Is not Representative Anderson's concerns found in the Dash 4 amendments under Section 5 that the EQC will adopt rules relating to dust suppression, and that will be one of the things that we'll look at?
Well, I think that's true, Representative Berea. I think the question of Representative Anderson, well, let him respond. I should be speaking.
Mr. Chairman, I think if we get specific direction under 1 and 2, that DEQ hands might be tied as far as allowing a generator, because we specifically said the only exemption are farmer households.
I think I can go along with that solely for the reason that, in fact, he's libeling himself as a generator.
You need to give your name each time you speak. Otherwise, we can't speak it up on the record. Go ahead.
Gary McCauley, SunWest Oil. I can go along with that because they are lowering the value of their own land. And as long as they fully understand the environmental risk and hazards they're putting on their own land, there's the American way. Nothing
to
stop them from doing it.
Mr. Chairman, Lori Parker from our staff just handed up an amendment to this, just changing a few words that would, if you decide to go this way, allow any property owner.
Why don't you give us a suggestion?
It would just change one to generated by the property owner. Instead of generated by a farmer household, it would just change it to generated by the property owner and then go on and use on the generator's property.
Yeah. And then we have two, which is used on the generator's property, and probably would follow. Yeah. Generated by the property owner.
Or lease owner.
Gary McCauley with SunWest Oil again. Keep in mind that if that oil leaches onto other people's land, they are still liable for that oil and would have to pay for any damage caused by the leaching.
Representative Johnson, you had a suggestion,
or
I think.
Lease owner. His properties are
generated by the property owner or lease owner. Yeah.
I have a real concern with that, and to give you a specific example, in the Medford area, many of the farmers and the commercial, such as Harry and David, would use the oil presently in their orchards. When you use it in a food chain area, my concern is that it not only picks up in the water table, but it picks up in the food chain itself. And you're allowing them, and they have a great number of vehicles, you're allowing them then to apply this material anywhere they want on their land, including their Dutch orchards access roads. And that's the type of thing we're trying to eliminate. So you should consider that. My name is Bill Briggs from Fuel Processors.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I do believe, though, under Section 5, that we're leaving an issue like that, or we are leaving up to the Environmental Quality Commission.
I hope that's true.
I feel comfortable that that if there were some real serious health hazards, that they would do that in the promulgation of their role.
Could that be,
but I certainly wouldn't expect them to those so-called clean operations there, to literally using their own motor oil, use motor oil to suppress dust. I hope that the Environmental Quality Commission wouldn't go that far. If I thought they would, I wouldn't support the bill.
But the DEQ understands, I think, what our concerns is, and you argue that, yes. I think, very broad authority under Section 5.
Yeah. Again, Peter Spenlow with DEQ. There was one concern we had if you added or leaser after property owner, and that is that the owner of the property might not know what the leaser is doing, and you know there could be a potential problem. The owner would need to somehow be notified before the leaser puts it out.
Just add with the approval of the owner.
I would make one more comment. Yeah, Bill Briggs, I just recently had the misfortune to purchasing a site where there was a lessor, and unknown to the person that I purchased it on, we had a $240,000 cleanup because of his activity. And I ended up with the bill simply because I was a new property owner coming along and was not aware of what happened, nor was the person that I bought it from, who was the property owner, not the lessor. So you are dealing with some real serious issues here. Bill Briggs again from Fuel Products.
Let me ask you that. In your particular situation, the owner was not aware of what the lessor had done.
That is absolutely correct. That was the key.
All right. I think Representative Johnson has suggested they add in generated the property owner or the lessor with the knowledge of the property owner. Would that take care of that?
Hopefully.
Representative Soa.
We seem to be talking about dust suppression when anybody makes a comment. However, this new Section 3 allows it to be used as a herbicide. Is that the concern of the rest of the committee that we're talking about herbicide or just dust suppression? I really couldn't support a broadening of the amendment to include herbicide off of the property of a farmer, but I could support for dust suppression.
I guess I don't think that happens, does it?
The intent, again, Peter Spendel with DEQ, the intent was to get at those places where the oil is being spread directly in the environment without any testing. That was the intent. And there could be people who, they in name, say they're doing it to kill weeds. In fact, what they're doing is spreading oil because they want to get rid of the oil. And so we included as an herbicide as well as for dust suppressant, just because it was something that is commonly done, at least in name, when in fact people are just getting rid of the waste that way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berea.
With a friendly amendment to Representative Anderson's concern, a lessor with written approval of the owner. I think I don't want to get into the problem of constructive knowledge and things like that.
I'll buy.
That's all right, isn't it? Let me ask the witnesses again on the question that Representative Soa asked. I guess I'm a little confused on the herbicide aspect. Perhaps we could discuss that a little bit further, would you?
Bill Briggs with Fuel Processors. It's not unusual, or wasn't in the past unusual, it is today, to find it used as a carrying agent for a dormant spray. So you would use it as the carrying agent and then add your herbicide to it and then spray.
Carrying it, okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Soa.
It would be my intention to strike the word herbicide if the rest of the committee saw fit.
Let me ask the committee what kind of a problem that would create if we took that phrase out as an herbicide.
Wouldn't it just eliminate that the issue wouldn't be regulated?
Well, I think that's
the
question.
Opposite.
Yeah, go ahead.
Gary McCauley with Sunwest Oil. If I'm interpreting this correctly, this is an exception. And so if you scratch herbicide, then herbicide would no longer be an exception. Isn't that correct?
As it stands at the moment, again, Peter Spendlow, DEQ, as it stands at the moment, the bill would prohibit a person from taking used oil and using it as an herbicide outside of their property. You couldn't go out and pick up used oil from a number of generators, add or not add or do whatever you want, and just take it and spray it on the ground somewhere. The same thing that you would, you know, the same concerns that you have for dust control would also stand if you were just, the intent is to ban or at least regulate the unrestricted use of used oil in the environment.
So as I understand, if you take that out, you in fact make it possible, you eliminate it, make it possible for people to use that and spread it.
Yeah.
Under current regulations, is that correct?
If that's the wishes of the committee.
If you leave it in, they could use it if they're on their own property, but otherwise they'd be precluded.
That's right.
Yeah. You, in effect, weaken it if you take it out.
Yes, if you take it out, you weaken the prohibition.
Any other questions? Where are you at this point, Representative Soa? I think your interest is in strengthening it. That would weaken it, as far as I could see. Anything else?
Ms. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
Somewhere in this mass of material, is there a definition of used oil? Is that in statute?
I believe it is in statute or regulation, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
One other question?
Yes.
I have a letter here from the Asphalt Pavement Association of Oregon. Are their concerns, have their concerns been addressed?
I'm not sure I'm the right one to answer that. Let's take a look at that.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can address that. The Asphalt Pavement Association, if I understood their testimony, was they did not want a bunch of different laws in different places that would they had two concerns. One was the possibility of directly using used oil in asphalt, and I don't see there's any problem in doing that the way this is written. The other one, though, was they were concerned about having different rules in different places, that the Environmental Quality Commission would adopt a whole set of used oil rules. And we have stated from the outset that we intend to stay with the federal program. The only place where we looked at going beyond was the dust control issue, because we thought that was an issue that needed to be addressed now. But other than that, we intended to follow the federal program so you wouldn't have different rules when you cross between Oregon and into Washington, for instance, or going into Idaho. All states that follow the federal rules pretty much regarding used oil.
Let me ask, before we move on to a motion, we've got a suggestion on line 10 to change it to read, generated by the property owner or lessor with written approval of the owner. Is that agreeable to everyone? Is there any objection to that amendment?
If
generated by the property owner or lessor with written approval of the owner. All right, we'll accept that amendment. Do I have a motion on the 1011A-4 as amended? Representative Maria.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the LC amendments 1011A-4 as further amended on line 10 as your directions.
All right, we have a motion to accept the amendment as amended by the friendly amendment on line 10. Is there any further discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll on amendment 1011A-4 as amended?
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Brea.
Aye.
Representative Ekes.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Parkinson.
No.
Representative Peterson. Aye. Representative Soa.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. Representative Brea moves Senate Bill 1011 as amended. Any further discussion? None. If the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Brea.
Aye.
Representative Ekes.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Parkinson?
No.
Great.
Representative Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Soa?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. The bill, Senate Bill 1011, passes. I was going to ask Representative Gilman to carry it, but he voted no. It's too bad.
He can change his vote.
Representative Peterson, would you like to carry this bill? All right, fine. Thank you. And with that, our work session on 1011 is closed, and we will be in recess until after the full session.
You can have time for your
coat.
It's presented to the floor, and I thank you on the floor.
That brought the roof down. As you recall, most of the people in the audience that gave testimony on the bill, it was in reference to that particular feature of it, and the testimony was mostly negative, though not all negative. The bill, as you now have before you, which is essentially Dash 5, makes a number of changes. First, it removes the provisions that would have set up mandatory recycling after July 1, 1988, and substitutes the requirement that there could be mandatory recycling after 1991 if recycling goals are not met in the meantime. In other words, it sets a period for mandatory recycling 3 years away, and that would could happen only if the recycling that's to go into effect, for example, in the city of Portland this next month, if there's not significant movement ahead. In other words, what you might call that is a Damocles sword above the area saying, move on with it, you're going to do voluntary recycling, we hope you have success with it, but in 3 years, if you've got a problem, you may end up having mandatory recycling. Secondly, the regional site issue, which you may recall was in there earlier at the request largely of Representative Fallbush, and the tipping fee issue has been removed. The business about citizen suit provisions have been removed. And then we've set out in the bill unequivocally that DEQ shall acquire the site. Not DEQ, that Metro shall acquire the site that DEQ selects. I would say it's still the two major provisions of the bill, one which has changed only in terms of some words, is that Metro will acquire the site at the point it is selected by DEQ. And I think I get a sense that most of the Metro officials have come around to that acceptance of the value of that. And let me come back and explain that to you in a bit, if I might. And then clearly on the recycling, the notion that the voluntary program will move forward, we support that. I think the criticism we got earlier that we were not giving that voluntary program a chance had merit. We certainly heard a great deal about it. And what we've now suggested is that mandatory might come in 3 years, but only if there is not significant movement. I know that still has a problem with some people, but I think some of the rest of us feel that it's useful to put the squeeze on a bit. The other provision, yes, let me indicate also the other, another major provision. In fact, let's go through this section by section so you understand it. Section 2 requires Metro to acquire the site selected by DEQ. Section 3 requires Metro to implement the solid waste reduction program approved by DEQ. That's really probably pretty much in the law currently. Section 4 requires Metro to report to DEQ on the various aspects of the implementation of the solid waste program and to set goals for recycling and reduction in the waste stream. The report is now due every 2 years, where previously I think we were talking about 5. Section 5 directs Metro to use various kinds of penalties and incentives to meet the goals set in 4. Section 6 determines whether Metro is meeting its goals and progress in acquiring the site, that is the landfill site. Section 7 makes reference to the mandatory recycling in 3 years if the goals are not met. Section 8 clearly provides that Metro may send its garbage to any site other than the one DEQ selects. In other words, waste management, a burner in Columbia County, any of those other sites could be, Metro would have clearly that authority. And I think as most everyone understands that probably Metro has that authority now. This would make it clear. But it eliminates the criteria need for choosing another site. In other words, I think that does loosen it up. Section 9 requires DEQ to report to the legislature on 9188 and then on 1189 and every 2 years thereafter. And then number 10, again, talks about the recycling within the region, within mandatory recycling within 3 years. A little bit of background. I think there's been some concern on the part of some of the interest groups over this provision of acquiring the sites, or acquiring the site once DEQ makes the selection. And I think there is some interest on the Senate side, perhaps one or two of the senators, in trying to put in another bill, kind of stuffing in another bill, trying to move back in terms of that selection requirement under current law. Clearly what is being said in this bill is not only is there no suggestion and no indication that we are expecting DEQ not to select the site, but when they select the site, Metro is required to secure it. Now, why is that? I think the reason for that is, in effect, to protect the Metropolitan Service District from, in effect, if you like, both the interest groups and a possible interest in the region when the thing gets hot, when that site is selected, that somehow there's a way out by going across the mountains or anyplace else for getting rid of the garbage. The bill clearly indicates that Metro may contract with anybody for that garbage, but there's a sense that in order to protect the region, it must have available its own site, so that it is not caught in a situation where later it's put on, the squeeze is put on it by any particular garbage interest, whether that should happen to be a public or private one. But if Metro wants to contract with waste management, or Metro wants to contract with other companies that may do business east of the mountains or in Columbia County or whatever, it's obviously free to do that. But it must acquire the site that is selected under DEQ. By DEQ. And I think one needs to recognize that it's been 2 years, DEQ has been in this business for 2 years, and prior to that, Metro has been in it for a long time. And we're saying you have to select the site under the law, the statute isn't going to change, you need to move on with it. Representative Anderson.
Well, I just wanted to confirm that the chair is solid on that point. Not let the record show he not in the affirmative. The second, I was just wondered if there's any type of a safety valve in here that, for example, waste management might want to do their own source separation and so on, recycling, in order to make it feasible. As to whether you just the collection is all in one and they separate it out through mechanical means at their site. And whether we had a safety, it's pretty definite here that they'll be providing this at the pickup point.
Ms. Anderson, I don't think there's anything in the bill that would preclude it. And one of the reasons that I think the three-year period is put in here is that we'll obviously have another legislative session before that time arrives. And clearly, if the region significantly does its recycling effort, or if it contracts with waste management or anything else to do that, and that shows, then the provision wouldn't go into effect anyway. But I think the purpose of having it there, having the three-year there, is to say the mandatory recycling may never happen, may not need to happen. But after the euphoria of the region that's currently there on the recycling effort maybe is gone in a year's time or 6 months' time, we want to be sure that that interest is not lost and that the major emphasis on recycling continues to be there. And what we're saying is that within 3 years, we expect to have significant progress in reference to recycling. But I'm not under any illusions that if this gets to be a problem, we may find it next session to be back. Matter of fact, I think this issue will be back to this legislature every session from now on, in one guise or another. It is a ongoing problem and probably will never be totally solved. That is, there's no solution to it, if you mean by that finish 100%. I don't expect to see it. Representative Berea.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion to move the amendments?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I move LC amendments 3390-5.
All right, it's been moved to 3390-5. Is there any further discussion? Representative Soa.
I'd like to amend the motion.
All right, Representative Soa.
I'd like to amend the motion to delete Section 7, or 5, 7, and 10.
Let me do this so it's clear. Representative Berea made a motion to approve the dash 5. Representative Soa's interest would substantially alter that. Let me take Representative Soa's motion first, since I think we can't take it afterwards. It doesn't make sense. What, does anybody have an objection to that? Yes, Representative Parkinson.
The motion is to substitute the motion.
Yes, that's true. It's a substitute.
And Representative Soa will have a chance to speak to his motion.
Yes, you have a chance right now to speak to it. Representative Soa. Everybody understands, again, repeat the motion. It would delete Section 4, 7.
No, 3.
5. Repeat it so we got them clear.
5, 7, 10.
5, 7, and 10.
So 5, 7, and 10. All right.
Okay.
To the motion. The reason I included Section 5 is because there's surcharges, penalties, and rate incentives in there to implement Section 4. Those of us that have lived in the outlying areas in the Metropolitan Service District know that there's a lot of distrust and a lot of hard feelings about the Metropolitan Service District. They've done a lot of things well, but they've made a lot of mistakes. I think if we pass penalties and rate incentives and things like that at this time, it will be counterproductive.
Now, 5 here talks about surcharges and penalties. 7?
7 is the one that requires cities basically to implement a recycling, curbside recycling, and if the committee will remember back when we had witnesses on this, I asked several questions about are there markets available, are the garbage haulers geared up for this kind of program, and in some places they are. Other places, they're just now starting to get geared up. And I think if we slap them with this right now, it's going to be counterproductive. We're going to be requiring a lot of material that there's no markets for to be recycled. And I think it's too early to do this. I think Metropolitan Service District, especially under our new administration there, has this as their key thing they're going to do in the next few years. And I think even if we don't require them, if we don't put it in the law, they're going to do it. And I think it would just be counterproductive at this time. And I think Section 10 just is kind of a some implementing language added to that particular ORS statute that implements 7, so that's the reason I included that. So in conclusion, I just think that while I am a strong advocate for recycling, I think that by mandating it in the law at this time that it's going to be counterproductive, and we'll get further by letting Metro implement the plan that they're going forward now. Section 4 will require them to come back in 2 years and tell the legislature how they've been doing, and if they have fallen short at that time, we can pass some mandatory legislation at that time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Brea.
It would be appropriate to ask to divide the question. I think there are two sections. One section 5 and the other is section 7 and 10.
Yes, I think that would be dependent on Representative Soa. He's the one that made the motion. Let me ask if I might, before we question him on that, if he understands that the mandatory recycling part would be effective only in 3 years, within 3 years, and that it would be applicable only if there's no evidence that there's significant movement on the recycling front at that point. All right, what about the separation? Would you be agreeable to separating the two?
Sure, any way the committee wants to vote on is fine with me.
All right, let's take Section 5 then.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Regarding Section 5, unless I'm mistaken, I believe they have that authority. Is there some way we could determine it?
Why don't you come up, Dennis, for a minute?